This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We begin with a subject we've covered a lot here on Radio Boston, the city of Boston and policing. Much of acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey's early tenure has been defined by two policing scandals that she inherited: the firing of Police Commissioner Dennis White, who years ago was accused of assaulting two women, and a review of how Officer Patrick Rose was allowed to remain on the force for 22 years after he was accused of child rape. Now, Janey asserts her handling of both cases shows her leadership as mayor is, quote, more transparent than anyone I can think of in recent history, end quote. She said that here on the show in May. A new WBUR investigation challenges that claim, and here to explain is WBUR reporter Allie Jarmanning. Allie, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, so the Dennis White and Patrick Rose cases, they've been highly publicized, but as you lay out, there are 13 other officers the department found committed domestic violence over the past decade. How do we know that?
Right, so to back up a bit, after the Patrick Rose and Dennis White news, I put in a public records request to the department asking for records about any officers who were investigated for sexual assault or domestic violence over the last 10 years. And I asked for cases where investigators sustained those allegations. That means Boston police investigators believe those officers committed the offense. But Boston refuses to provide any of the actual records. However, they did finally provide me with numbers. They say 13 officers committed domestic violence, and another was found to have committed sexual assault.
Okay, and what do we know?
Not a whole lot. They won't provide any records whatsoever, not even the officers' names. We don't know if the 13 officers who committed domestic violence are still working with the department. The department did say that the officer who committed sexual assault isn't with the Boston police anymore, but we don't know their name, so we can't see if that officer ended up working for another police department. Separately, I also found out about an officer who still works for the department. In 2014, his daughter went to Hingham Police and said he'd sexually abused her in their home. Hingham passed that information on to Boston, which investigated and ruled the complaint unfounded. Neither Boston nor Hingham will provide any more information, so we don't know if the officer has been accused in other incidents.
Okay. So what is the city's explanation for not releasing more information?
So the police department says it's barred from providing these records under the state domestic violence and rape shield law. And that law is designed to protect victims. During her press conference today, Janey said she was committed to transparency and wants to staff up the police watchdog agency that was signed into law before she took office. She says our reporting underscores the need for these oversight offices.
Records will be released. We will continue to release internal affair files. As we do so, I want to remind you that we will always, always protect the identities of survivors and victims in this case, and we do not want to do anything that would jeopardize new victims in the future from coming forward.
Janey hasn't said how the city was able to release some records on Rose and White under the law, but not those for other officers who aren't in the headlines. And I should add, the Boston Globe is suing the city over its refusal to release more records about White and Rose. They're challenging how the city is interpreting the law.
And just to clarify for our listeners, that police watchdog agency, because we've talked about it a lot here on air, you're talking about the Office of Police Accountability and Transparency there, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so what do advocates and attorneys have to say about this? I know you reached out to some.
Yeah, so domestic violence and sexual assault lawyers and advocates were struck by the inconsistency. Why could the department release records about Dennis White and Patrick Rose, but not these other officers who aren't front page news? And they say there are ways to protect the victims without protecting perpetrators. And they warned that by hiding records about police who commit domestic or sexual assault, it could break down trust with victims.
All right. So this all comes as Acting Mayor Janey is campaigning for a full term. Maybe you can just summarize for us, Allie, how this issue is affecting the race.
Yeah, so as expected, some of her mayoral rivals are criticizing her for not releasing these records. Three of her four challengers, John Barros, Andrea Campbell, and Michelle Wu, say the city should immediately make the records public. Barros told me today that the city shouldn't be waiting on the formation of the new Office of Police Accountability and Transparency to release these records. He said, we shouldn't use bureaucracy and our inability to implement the recommendations as a reason not to release them. Let's release them now, make sure that the people of Boston are informed and that those who need to be held accountable are held accountable. I also spoke to Councillor Andrea Campbell. She said there's nothing stopping the Janney administration from releasing records before OPAT, the Office of Police Accountability and Transparency, gets up and running. And she said it's absurd that the city can release records on Patrick Rose, but not about these other officers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she said if we really value transparency in the city, that the mayor needs to be more forthcoming. And she says she's seen a pattern of the acting mayor acting like the previous administration. And Campbell says she's filing a subpoena as a councilor for records on these officers. Councilor Wu said in a statement that, quote, Bostonians deserve transparency, accountability, and real reforms, not announcements that fail to follow through. The only councilor who didn't say that the records should be immediately released was Councilor Anissa Asabi George. She said she couldn't speak to the legality of releasing records, but said that any officers who don't, quote, serve and lead their lives with integrity should not be on the BPD. Of course, we don't know if they're still serving because we don't know who these officers are.
Okay, Allie, stand by, please. I'm going to come back to you in a bit, but I want to bring in another voice here. Let's talk for more context with Sophia Hall, who's an attorney with Lawyers for Civil Rights. Sophia, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Sophia, just to start, does Allie's reporting track with your personal experience?
Absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, it shouldn't take a scandal for us to have to yet again look at the issues of transparency through the city of Boston. But this is a time-old era issue that we have been fighting for years and years. We've had lawsuits that date back more than half a decade, even trying to ensure that the city complies with what happens to be a fairly progressive public records statute in Massachusetts.
Okay, so at one level, I know this question is going to sound basic, but I actually think it's important to kind of go back to first principles. Why is transparency in these situations so important, Sophia?
So transparency in terms of a taxpaying citizen and a government entity is sort of the cornerstone of democracy, right? In order to participate, you have to know what your government is in fact doing, and you're entitled to know that. That said, in an era right now where police reform is at the forefront, where we are looking to, in fact, improve relationships between communities of color and law enforcement departments, that information becomes that much more important to us.
So lots of questions that kind of flow in my head from there. Okay, so the city argues that protecting identities of victims is important. We know that there is that tension here. The victims of domestic violence or sexual assault are less likely to come forward in the future if they fear that their privacy is at risk. That is part of how acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey is pushing back here, saying that there's concerns about that. How do we think about balancing transparency with the privacy of victims, and what are the techniques to get as transparent as possible with records without that threat coming into play? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Absolutely. And I mean, every leader, no matter what sector we're talking about, bears the burden of balancing lots of different interests. And again, not saying that I want the job. That said, we certainly know that there is a middle ground here. As a lawyer, I regularly receive documents that are redacted. And for those that don't know what that means, it means, in fact, you black out so that you cannot visually see on the record itself information that you don't want shared. What could very well happen here is that these records could be disclosed, but all of the personally identifiable information of victims could be redacted. And what that allows for is to meet both of those interests, the concerns of the victims, but also the equal importance of the community to know the people who are policing them, that are supposed to keep them safe, yet have these sustained issues of domestic violence or even sexual assault on their record.
All right. So do you believe that this is exclusively a cultural dimension? Do you think there's other things standing in the way of transparency? And what does it cost you in your ability to do your work when that transparency isn't there?
Oh, good question. And it's sort of loaded. But let me say this. In any community, that has not been forced to really listen to the lived experience of the community members that they serve. And I say here, that's Boston. There's been really no push to rock the boat and do things differently than what we've seen in the prior administration or even the administration before that. Here, there's an interest in keeping the status quo. And unfortunately, we need that to change. We need transparency to be a priority and perhaps to be the priority to ensure that the community can have a meaningful voice in the way that it's governed. What is at stake if that doesn't happen? Well, a lot of taxpayer dollars and a lot of time and energy by advocates who have not just the issue of transparency, but countless other civil rights issues to tackle that they can't tackle because they can't get the critical data they need that they're entitled to under the Massachusetts public records law.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, at some level, I'm imagining what you're saying is there is a back and forth that does and needs to happen in order to hold everyone accountable and have the contested issues be effectively contested. And that's what we miss when we don't have this transparency, correct?
That's true. And unfortunately, the only time we see that back and forth, as you describe, is when attorneys or other individuals expend the costs of going into court, getting a judge involved, and getting a court order for these entities, the government, the city of Boston, to do what the law already requires them to do.
So I want to bring Allie Jarmanning back in here. And Allie, thanks for waiting for a minute there. I'm struck by this idea of the burden of the cost and the lift to overcome this wall or this opacity. React to that.
Yeah, you know, all I can think about is just how difficult it is in this state to get records. Even after the state passed a public records reform law a couple years ago that was supposed to make it easier. You know, I used to be a reporter in Columbus, Ohio, and I covered, it was a large police department as big as Boston. It was so much easier to get records and report on what was happening within the department. And it's just not the same here for some reason. And that doesn't only affect me as someone who's savvy enough to know how to ask for these records and push back. I can't imagine being a person in the general public trying to ask for records and being told no. I'm thinking about people who are victims of crimes or family members of victims or people that just want to find out what's going on in their neighborhood. By not just getting rejected or not hearing back at all, it has to be so frustrating, and it's really not good for the city.
So I want to ask the last question to the two of you. So now we have a good sense of what it costs us to not have transparency. What would be different if we did? For you as a journalist, Allie, for you as an attorney, Sophia, and Sophia, maybe briefly I'll start with you. What would be different if you did?
We could move forward much more quickly in terms of resolving systemic issues that we see plaguing our communities of color if we only had the information to figure out where to start and how to draft and create those solutions.
All right. Thank you. And Allie, how about for you?
Yeah, I just think we wouldn't see this kind of drip, drip, drip of information that comes out. You know, I'm thinking about the Patrick Rose case. The only reason why we have him in the news again after he was charged last year was because the Boston Globe found that he had been investigated back in the 90s. And that's why we're talking about him now. And so if this information had been out there in the first place, maybe we wouldn't have had these. I mean, who knows how things would have been different, but it just we would have known more and people would have maybe been able to protect themselves.
All right. That is WBUR reporter Allie Jarmanning and Sophia Hall, an attorney with Lawyers for Civil Rights. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Right now, employers and businesses across the state are weighing the pros and cons of requiring workers to be vaccinated. But for some, the government is actually forcing their hand. On Wednesday, yesterday, Governor Charlie Baker mandated that all nursing home employees be fully vaccinated by October 10th. It is his first and only vaccine mandate so far. Cases and hospitalizations are rising, particularly among the unvaccinated, and that raises the question of whether there may be more in the pipeline. Here with a bird's eye view of Beacon Hill and what might be next is WBUR Senior Statehouse reporter Steve Brown. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Tiziana.
All right, so Steve, let's start with the latest. The Commonwealth announces yesterday that all nursing home and long-term senior care facilities must now require employees to be vaccinated by October 10th. It's the first mandate handed down by Governor Baker. He was not the first mover here. We're actually going to speak shortly with Hebrew Senior Life, a nonprofit senior living organization that announced a mandate for its employees last month. But it is a big move. Why did the governor do it? And why did the governor do it now?
Well, the administration says that these employees work directly with a population that is most vulnerable to COVID. Now, 3/4 of those nursing home employees have already been vaccinated, but the Baker administration wants to drive that number up closer to 100%. They will allow exemptions for medical and religious grounds, but those are expected to be few and far between. As to why now, there's definitely an uptick in the transmission of the virus due to the Delta variant. So I think they want to get ahead of any potential spread inside these facilities, and they believe having everyone who works in them vaccinated is the most effective way to keep the nursing home residents safe.
So, Steve, each time one of these things happens, and it's sort of the first, it's really important to know how it's going to work because that can set precedent. So how is this one going to work?
Yeah, the state is going to work with the operators of the facilities to make sure that all the employees are vaccinated by October 10th. These facilities are licensed by the state, so the state does have the authority to step in and require this.
All right, so a few questions come to mind. Steve, first, any hint that this is the shape of things to come from the governor for other industries, private industries, basically?
Well, the governor's going to plead, beg, and badger people who have been reluctant to get a shot to get vaccinated. But he's more inclined to continue using a carrot rather than a stick. I suppose the severity of infections will play a role as we go on. The number of infections are up because of Delta, but other key stats such as hospitalizations and deaths remain somewhat in check. They've gone up a little bit, but they're not anywhere near what we were looking at a year ago. As for other industries, there's only so much that the state can do with privately run businesses that are not subject to state regulation.
Okay, how about public employees, the state itself, and the people who work for the state?
Sure. As far as those in the executive branch, the governor has said all along he has no intention of requiring employees that fall under his control to be vaccinated. Keep in mind, many of those employees are union members who fall under collective bargaining agreements. So imposing a vaccination mandate is a change in working conditions that needs to be negotiated first. And I sense the administration would like to avoid that if at all possible. Now, some other state employees who are not under the umbrella of the executive office are being required to be vaccinated. We should note that Attorney General Mara Healey's office, State Auditor Suzanne Bump's office, and Treasurer Deborah Goldberg's office have each mandated vaccines or regular COVID testing for their employees. Each of those leaders is independently elected rather than, say, a cabinet secretary who works for the governor.
Do you think that that creates extra pressure on the governor, Steve?
It does to a certain extent because, you know, people are saying, well, you know, these other agencies are doing it. Why not you? But as I mentioned before, there are a lot more people that fall under the executive branch. And, you know, you have those union contracts and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
He'd rather them do that voluntarily than to have to mandate it.
So you've hit that theme a couple of times, that he'd rather, you know, entice people and convince people to do it. The governor seems to me to have been pretty reticent to impose statewide actions since the lifting of his emergency powers in June. I'm thinking, for example, of insisting that localities should make the decision about masking in their school districts rather than the state making a statewide mandate there. Is it surprising at all to you to see him step into this industry in this way?
No, I think when it comes to the nursing homes, the administration figures they are regulated by the state. So it's not an overreach to impose additional requirements. And then going back to, you know, those vulnerable populations that they deal with. No one wants to see grandma or grandpa get sick. When it comes to dealing with school districts, there is a reluctance for the state to interject since the districts are all autonomous and they answer first to local officials. So the governor tends to like to stay in his lane when dealing with municipalities, even though the state does have a say in curriculum.
So he's in the corner office. What about the rest of Beacon Hill? Lawmakers, is there movement from them that they'd like to see some mandates? Is there anything that they're thinking about doing, or are you hearing anything about that?
I haven't heard much about vaccine mandates. Several legislators have individually been critical of the Baker administration for not putting forth a mask mandate for kids in preschool through sixth grade. Of course, at this time, those kids are not eligible for the vaccine. So as we get closer to the first day of school, I would expect to hear that debate ramp up even more.
Right. And are there any policies on Beacon Hill itself right now regarding vaccines?
There is not, other than strong encouragement that all State House employees get vaccinated. As you know, the State House remains closed to the public, and most legislators and their staffs are being told to work remotely whenever possible. I did a story a couple of weeks ago about how the State House is still closed and found that the legislature hasn't even surveyed its members or their staff about whether or not they've been vaccinated. They haven't even asked the question.
All right, so Steve, I got to ask you then, what are you watching for next?
Well, let's see how this Delta variant goes. If we're going to have more outbreaks there's going to be a taxing of the medical system, if they see that on the horizon, I think then they're going to start hunkering down as we approach the fall. The governor and everyone in the state is saying, get vaccinated. And they're going to, try to do that, as I say, the carrot, not the stick. But the stick is, in the corner and can always be used.
Oh, that's a great image. All right. WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown. Always a pleasure, Steve. Thanks.
Good talking with you, Tiziana.
All right, we want to continue exploring this question of whether and when to mandate vaccination, and we're going to invite you in here. Is your employer mandating vaccinations, or are you a business owner? Are you the employer, and you are thinking about or are implementing a vaccine mandate for your employees? And we also want to know if you would patronize a business that required you to be vaccinated as a customer. Would you want to go there more? Would you want to go there less? Not at all. Call us. 1-800-423-8255 is the number. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. We have two guests with us to continue this conversation. First, we have Lou Wolf. He is the CEO of Hebrew Senior Life, the largest senior healthcare organization in New England. They were ahead of the curve and announced a vaccine mandate for their 2,000-plus employees on July 26th. Also with us, Matt Smith, managing director at Club Passim in Harvard Square. Club Passim is requiring proof of vaccination from all staff, performers, and patrons starting tomorrow. Lou, Matt, great to have you both here on Radio Boston.
Great to be part of this important conversation.
Yeah, thanks for inviting us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Lou, I'm going to start with you. Hebrew Senior Life announced it would mandate vaccines for all current and new employees almost a week before the state did it. Walk us through why you decided a mandate was the way to go as an employer.
Well, we as an organization are highly committed, been around for 117 years, committed to helping the residents and patients we care for live their very best lives. And as soon, for years, we have been very proactive about flu vaccines. And we got to a point a few years ago where we got up to about 90% of our employees getting flu vaccines. And we mandated in 2018 and moved to very close to 100%. The reason we did that was because in order for older adults to live their best lives, as Steve pointed out, in this industry, there needs to be a tremendous amount of engagement by staff with residents. You have people who are frail. You have people with dementia. There's a lot of high-touch environments. As the pandemic got to a point where vaccines were available, we really knew from the start that at some point, mandating would be critical to get that last 10 to 15%. So in July, early July, we decided that we had reached enough critical mass. We were approaching 80% of our staff. When we did it in July 26th, we were at 85%. And we realized that that was a point where it was time to mandate it, because as I said, that's the only way to get to close to 100%, which is where we really have to be in order to help our residents and patients live their best lives.
And has it worked? I mean, are you seeing a change in the numbers already?
Well, it's been a week and a half. We knew that it would take a little while to socialize this. We have seen definitely a number of people step up and get vaccinated. We've seen a real ramp up in serious conversations that people were perhaps avoiding previously. We've had very, very few people so far, I think four, put in an application for an exemption, either medical or religious. So I wouldn't say we've had a tidal wave of new vaccines being given yet, but our sense is that it will occur, and the deadline is October 1st, as was noted, and that's when it has to be fully effective. So people really need to get their vaccine, the last dose, by September 17th in order for it to be fully effective by October 1st. So we do expect over the next, you know, 4 or 5 weeks to see that ramp up.
All right, so Matt, I'm going to turn to you now in Club Passim, and part of the reason to bring you to the table is that you are looking at your customers and now asking your customers to be vaccinated. That begins tomorrow. That's got to be a big decision, too. Why'd you do it, and was that a hard decision to make?
Well, it's a hard decision just because it, you know, brings no joy in saying to anyone that you can't come in. But it, to me, it's a public health issue. We talked about this as we looked at the city, and we looked at the, you know, how the Delta variant is progressing, and just the need for us to be very mindful of public safety for our staff, for our performers, and for our audience. And this was the safest way to move forward for now. You know, we don't want this to go on forever this way, but for right now, it is the safest way for us to continue doing business.
Don't really keyed in on that for now. Do you have some sense of, I mean, is there like a metric or a threshold or something that you're going to see that's going to make you decide it's no longer necessary? Or are you just, is it kind of, you'll know it when you see it, but you don't know what that is?
Yeah, I think it is just kind of a wait and see approach. Right now, we have had an overwhelmingly positive response to the policy from both performers and audience members, who are saying now they do feel safer coming to the club, and we know that it's going to be upsetting to some people, but this is more about a public health issue at large than it is about the individual, and we need to be just as mindful as possible about that.
And I'm going to bring Lou back in a second, but I do want to ask you, you've had this out on your website. What are you hearing from customers about this move?
Oh, for us, for Club Passim, it's mostly positive. I'd say 95%+ positive.
All right. So I want to bring Lou back in here. Lou, I'm going to ask you a question that, Matt, I'm probably going to ask you something similar. Lou, vulnerable populations. Early on, we heard a lot about concern in communities of color over the legitimacy and safety of vaccines, especially given the racial history of medicine and healthcare in this country. How do you think about that with your employee base percentages or some amount of your employee base who might have those concerns? And how do you respond compassionately to those while you enact a mandate like this?
It's a great question, because we have a high percentage of our employees are people of color. And there's no question that early on, particularly because the information and the way it was being spun in some of the press was focusing on that. And from the start, as vaccines have been available, we have understood that when somebody has a concern, whether or not we believe it is scientifically based, it is a legitimate concern in their mind based on the experiences they've had. And we have, from the start, listened and talked it through and respected the opinions that people have when they do have concerns. I believe that we've been doing that now for a good 7 or 8 months. And even during this period, after we announced the mandate, we did announce it on July 26th, effective October 1, to still have the time to continue to have those conversations. We are a teaching organization. We're an affiliate of Harvard Medical School, so we do have the advantage of having a staff that does respect science. So with many of them, you know, as we sit down and we talk it through, we have found that once we are, you know, very clear about it and open and respectful, that they do ultimately see that it is the right thing to do.
All right. And Matt, I want to take the flip side of that same coin with you, because in addition to requiring customers to be vaccinated, you are requiring your staff to, you're requiring performers to. That is your livelihood. You need the performers. And it's a tight job market. But in this case, what we mean by tight job market is it's hard to get enough employees, right? There's a lot of competition for employees. Are there risks that there are people who are vaccine hesitant for the kinds of reasons that we've talked about, who may say, I got to go somewhere else. I'm not going to do this. And how have you thought about that? And are you engaged with your performers and your employees in that conversation?
We absolutely are. And we have internally unanimous support for this decision. We want to make sure that we are leading by example with our staff and performers to then have our audience come along, because it is about the science. And agreed, you know, having those respectful conversations with people is an important part of this, because we are all learning as we go along, and we want to hear those opinions, but primarily we are focused on safety right now. And while you can't, you know, be the answer to everyone's question the way they want it, we're going to be mindful of that and continue to have those conversations and work with people, because we've during the past year and a half, we have made our ability to live stream our shows become much better. So people are able to stay home and watch the shows still and engage in what we're doing, to take our classes and workshops online and safely in their own comfortable space. So we're working with how we can still make sure that everyone is engaged while keeping the folks that are coming to the actual venue safe.
So could I just add something? Matt, please do.
Well, I want to add that just for your listeners, I've been part of a lot of conversations over the last few months where people keep focusing on those people who are vaccine hesitant and the risk of them leaving. We live in a very educated community in general here in Massachusetts. There are just as many people, if not more, who are at risk of leaving your organization if you don't mandate, because they want to be around other people who are vaccinated. And people don't focus on that enough. And I think people have to keep that in mind just as much, if not more, than the fear of the vaccine hesitant to be leaving.
You know, I, just to back that up, Lou, recent polling by the COVID-19 Consortium for understanding the public's policy preferences across states showed relatively strong support actually in the Commonwealth for vaccine mandates relative to other states. Yeah, just to underscore that. I do find myself wondering, though, Matt, I mean, you guys have had live performances since June 20th. Now we're in August. You're doing this now. Was it just slow in coming because you had to ramp it up, or has something changed? And by something, I mean Delta, changed in the last month that you weren't going to do this and now you are?
Absolutely. We talked about it at the beginning, and we didn't feel that the need was as strong early on. Whereas, you know, where the Delta variant is fast moving and very, very contagious, that we, you know, we just need to be taking as many safety measures as possible.
And at the same time, I just, Matt, music in a time of trauma, how important is it to make sure that you can bring live music to people in a time like this?
Incredibly important. We found that was true over the past, you know, since we shut down last March, that remaining engaged and continuing to employ artists so that they're able to make a living, so that they're able to get their music out to people, has been important, not just for the audience, but for the performers. It is their livelihood. And this is how we can help sustain our community.
And Lou, as we go out, similar question to you. Families of older adults, this has been a staggeringly traumatic 18 months. How important is it for you to be able to provide them with a sense of confidence and safety in this moment, especially with all the uncertainty that the Delta variant seems to be re-injecting into our COVID landscape?
Absolutely critical. From as soon as the vaccines became available, there were outcries from family members not wanting their mom to have their hair washed by somebody who wasn't vaccinated or have their meal served. So absolutely. When we announced this vaccine, I received an outpouring of thanks and support, and I have not received one communication of any type of anybody against it. I would say that we did not react to this because of the Delta variant. We always lived in knowledge that this is morphing constantly and made the decision to do this kind of in anticipation of Delta variant or something else, and do plan on. I anticipate this will be a long-term requirement, just as many other vaccines are required for people to come to work to a healthcare environment.
Okay. Lou Wolf is the CEO of Hebrew Senior Life, largest senior healthcare organization in New England. And Matt Smith is managing director at Club Passim in Harvard Square. Lou, Matt, thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much, Tiziana.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Before the break, we talked about vaccine mandates for employers, for customers, and we're going to stay on that subject, but turning now to, of all things, the NFL. So their season starts tonight. Well, technically, preseason games start tonight. The New England Patriots will have their first preseason game next Thursday. But as the league has geared up for another season destined to be impacted by COVID, there have been some interesting developments, and those may offer some lessons that can help guide all of us as we try to figure out how to navigate this new normal. So we want to talk about that. Here to check the score with us for the NFL is Radio Boston's Chris Sidorick. Hey there, Chris.
Hey, Tiziana.
All right, so I know we were saying a few weeks ago that the NFL had a really big problem potentially brewing. A lot of players resisting vaccination. Where do we stand now?
Yeah, it's pretty staggering. Just about a month ago, you had a bunch of teams that had less than 50% of their players vaccinated. League-wide, less than 70% of players were vaccinated. You had players kind of posting their concerns on social media. But as of yesterday, the NFL is now up to 90% of players across the league are vaccinated. According to the Washington Post, the Minnesota Vikings have the lowest single team vaccination rate. 70% of their players are fully vaccinated or in the process. So really, they've made a lot of progress in just a few short weeks here.
All right, those are numbers that would be the envy of states, employers, et cetera. Yeah. It's been fascinating to watch this turnaround, Chris.
Yeah, and they've done it through a few different tools. They've taken advantage of education and incentives. I keep thinking about this carrot and the stick conversation you had with City Councilor Michelle Wu yesterday. I heard you talking with Steve Brown about it today. The NFL has kind of got a foot in both worlds, basically. So they've created benefits for folks who are vaccinated. They don't have to wear a mask around team facilities. They get tested every 14 days instead of every day, like unvaccinated players. And they don't have some of the same restrictions off the field that unvaccinated players do. But they've also come down hard on unvaccinated players, including potentially forcing teams to forfeit if there's an outbreak among unvaccinated players. And that includes forfeiting game pay. So that obviously leads to some peer pressure. But I also think education has been an element of this, too. And I've been really struck by the situation in Washington. Head coach Ron Rivera has talked about these teaching moments. He was diagnosed with cancer last year and underwent chemotherapy as part of his treatment. And he's been talking about hesitancy to get the vaccine amongst his players. And you can hear the frustration. Here he is talking about it with reporters last week.
I'm truly frustrated. I'm beyond frustrated. You know, and part of it is, and the reason I walked in with the mask on is, you know, I'm immune deficient. I just wish and I hope that our guys can understand that.
For a long time, Washington had one of the lowest vaccination rates in the league. They're now up to 84% of their players are fully vaccinated. So I think it really shows kind of how that personal connection really can make a difference too.
Okay, briefly on this forfeit thing. When the NFL first announced that, you and I were going back and forth on Twitter about it, because that strikes me as pretty fierce. That seems next level. Talk a little more about that.
Yeah, the NFL obviously has resisted mandating a vaccine, but this is about as close as you can get without doing that. And they've basically drawn a distinction. If there's an outbreak amongst unvaccinated players, the team with the unvaccinated players that had the outbreak are potentially on the hook financially for any canceled games and could face discipline from the commissioner's office. Whereas if it's an outbreak among vaccinated players, the league says they're going to do everything they can to balance competitive and economic burdens for both teams. So really trying to draw a distinction between unvaccinated players and vaccinated players, and I should say staff and coaches as well.
All right, so let's bring this local. How is this playing out for the New England Patriots?
Well, this is really going to shock you because I know how transparent and open the Patriots usually are about information. We don't really know. We do know quarterback Cam Newton was asked today if he's been vaccinated. He said that's too personal to discuss. I was really struck by this moment yesterday. Bill Belichick was talking to reporters. And just listen to this exchange with Henry McKenna, who covers the Pats for the Patriots Wire.
Are you willing to share whether you are vaccinated?
Yeah, we're not going to get into that.
Okay. But do you think that you will be disclosing at any point whether, like, what percentage of the team is vaccinated this year?
Yeah, I don't know. Those are really medical questions.
Okay, so we are not going to get anything from Bill Belichick.
From Bill. That's right.
All right, but Chris, sit tight, because we might be able to learn a little bit more from Boston Globe senior NFL writer Ben Volen. Ben, welcome back.
Thanks for having me today.
So you cover this team. Chris just showed us pretty clearly we're not going to find out straight from the horse's mouth, but you were at practice today. What can you tell us about how the Patriots have handled the vaccine, COVID protocols in general?
There's not too much notice of it at practice. The players don't have to wear masks during practice. The one thing you do notice, however, is unvaccinated players, they do have to wear a mask coming on and off the field. So at the beginning of practice and the end of practice. And Cam Newton has been a player who has been wearing a mask in those situations. So that kind of leads me to believe that he may be unvaccinated, and then his refusal to answer the question today, you know, fuels that fire a little bit more. And he might want it to be a private matter, but it's very much a public matter, especially because if you're not vaccinated, you can get pulled from the team at any moment if you're a high-risk close contact of someone who becomes infected with the virus. The Vikings just lost their top three quarterbacks for 5 days because they weren't vaccinated. They were close contacts. One of them got COVID. It happened on a Saturday. If that happened to happen during the regular season, the Vikings would have had to find a fourth string quarterback to play. So for the Patriots, if Cam Newton's not vaccinated, that's a big deal because he's at risk of getting pulled from the lineup at any time. So it is a public decision. It's noticeable that Bill Belichick has not provided any information about it. Part of that, I think, is just him. He always wants to keep things in-house. But part of me wonders if he is protecting a guy like Cam Newton, where it does seem like most of the Patriots probably are vaccinated, and maybe Cam is one of the few holdouts, and maybe Belichick is kind of protecting him a little bit by not revealing the team's numbers, because most coaches and most teams have been pretty open about where they're at with the vaccinations, and 90% of players league-wide have gotten it. So the Patriots are being noticeably quiet, and you know, it might be a case of Belichick kind of protecting the few guys that are the holdouts.
Chris,
I'm curious. Yeah. I'm curious, Ben. I know the NFL Player Association is now starting to push back on some of these protocols. They're calling for daily testing for everybody, even vaccinated players, for example. Have you heard anything new on that? And do you expect the league to make any adjustments based on those concerns?
Well, that's certainly part of the back and forth going on between the NFLPA and the league office right now. And you know, the NFLPA, their concern is they don't like the fact that the unvaccinated players are really getting singled out. You know, they had, like, in the team facilities, they have to wear a different colored wristband or a different colored lanyard around their name tag to kind of identify that they're unvaccinated.
Yeah, you've had some players refer to that as segregation too. I've heard.
Again, I don't think that's an appropriate. You know, since you can easily just get a vaccine, but. Yes, I mean, and players are upset about it. And so the NFLPA, what they, in suggesting and recommending daily testing, I think it's part of, they don't want the unvaccinated players to be singled out. And meanwhile, you've got players like tight end Jimmy Graham who are saying, well, wait a second, you just told me I have to get the vaccine because now I only get tested once every 14 days. Now you're telling me I'm going to have to get tested every day. So players are kind of upset about that now. Like they feel like they were forced to get the vaccine, and then their union is kind of changing course here. I don't think it's going to get to that point. You know, the NFLPA, they said, like, there's already been an outbreak in Atlanta and Miami, and the NFL came out last night and said, we do not think that was an outbreak. There were a few isolated cases, but because we're so well vaccinated, there wasn't an outbreak and it wasn't a major issue. And we have it all under control now. And I think this is one area where the NFLPA might be able to raise a stink, but I just don't think, you know, the NFL still calls the shots, and I don't think there's a real appetite to have vaccinated people getting tested every day. It just doesn't seem necessary, and there's a high cost to it. And the NFL really is trying to more or less shame players into getting the vaccine.
All right, that's Ben Volen, senior NFL writer for the Boston Globe. Helpful to have the inside peek there, Ben. I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you very much.
So, Chris, lessons here for the rest of us. You know, as you know, I've been intrigued to watch the NFL sort of be a proving ground for all kinds of potential policies here. What do you think we're learning?
I think there's some things to be pretty encouraging here in terms of folks don't like the word mandate, right? And being forced to do something, you kind of get natural resistance right away. I think the NFL is showing you can create some success through some of these incentives and education efforts and get folks vaccinated without necessarily forcing their hand into it. And I think that's that has me feeling pretty optimistic.
So I stay on that optimism for a second and tell me what you think we're going to see. I mean, these are, again, big changes. We might have predicted some doom and gloom for the schedule a couple of weeks ago. The numbers are changing. Do you anticipate a relatively smooth football season, or with the Delta variant, is it just too soon to know?
I mean, I think we don't know ultimately, but I think you can't go wrong with 90%+ of your players and staff vaccinated. I think that's a really good sign.
All right. So, Chris, that's the NFL. We've got just a couple of minutes left. What else do you want to cover on the world of sports now?
Yeah, and I just want to take some time to highlight something that I think really resonated here in Boston. And thanks for having me, Tiziana, and letting me do this. I want to talk about Terrence Clark briefly. We've talked about him on the show before.
Yeah.
Just an absolute basketball prodigy who grew up here in Boston, grew up playing at the Vine Street Community Center in Roxbury. Incredibly talented, went to the University of Kentucky. I want to acknowledge I didn't know him personally, but I've talked to folks that do, and everyone who knew him you know, says he was warm and kind and just loved the game and loved the city of Boston so deeply. He tragically passed away in April at the age of 19 in a car crash. He had declared for the NBA draft the month before. He was expected to be picked in the second round. His name would have been called in the NBA draft last week, and actually last Thursday night in the middle of the first round, it was.
With us this evening is Terrence's mom, Azmin, his brother Gavin, his sister, Tatiana. To the three of you, and to all of those who knew and admired Terrence, please know that he will forever be part of the NBA family. It is my honor to now announce that with the next pick in the 2021 NBA draft, the NBA selects Terrence Clark from the University of Kentucky.
So we just wanted to let you sit with that to close the show today. And I thank Chris Sitterick for bringing it to us. That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Thanks for listening. Tune in again tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.